Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Jolson.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. By popular demand, this being the beginning of October 2016, I'm going to dedicate today's podcast to the Iron Guard and Cornelius Quadrianu and the movement of the Legion of the Archangel Michael in Romania. There have been many, many, many people who over the years have asked me to tackle this subject, and this is what I'm going to be doing today. And I want to bring out some new things, some new ideas that haven't been dealt with before, at least not in English, and make this as original as possible. But before we get into that, I need to make an appeal. It's an embarrassing appeal, but one that I have no choice but to make. As most of my listeners and supporters know, in the middle of 2014, I began the process of divorce, which was forced upon me, and the costs of that have left me very deeply in debt. About $25,000 in legal fees and other associated expenses, moving out, so, these kind of things. So, having given away so much, my articles and these podcasts for free, I'm asking financial assistance from my supporters, whatever you can. I come from money. My father was a successful businessman in the funeral business, and it's very difficult for me to ask for money. I'm not used to it. I'm not used to even having to worry about it. This is all legal fees and associated fees. That's the debt, and I'm paying these guys and putting everything else on credit cards. So now, it's a position that a lot of men especially are in, having gone through this. And my website has a donation button, which will bring you right to PayPal. And whatever you can do, I would very much appreciate. There was a time where giving this stuff away for free was no problem at all. I wouldn't dream of taking money for it. But now, and for those of you who I don't know if you know or not, but the hiatus that the Orthodox Nationalist was on was because of all this. And I just simply didn't have the energy or the motivation to continue. This takes a tremendous amount of preparation and focus because it's all substance. It's all on top. There's no fluff here. And it's very specialized, and this is, it takes a lot of work. I'm usually exhausted when it's over. But really, it's the only thing in the world I know how to do. Lecturing in front of a classroom, researching, writing, speaking like this. This is really all I know how to do. This is why I'm here. I know I reach a lot of people. And I appreciate your support. Some have already donated to me, and I would appreciate support from others. So I'm asking your assistance, and that will be once I'm settled and back on track again. Of course, I'll remove any reference to donations or anything else. But unfortunately, today I'm very, very deeply in debt, and I ask your help. Anyway. I can't count the number of people who have asked me, begged me, to do something on the Iron Guard. And to be honest, I'm not entirely sure why I haven't in the past. My very first published paper in grad school was on King Carol of Romania. I was kind of neutral on the Iron Guard, but being a monarchist, I was supporting actually both Carols. Not realizing at the time how rotten the second one was, and just how great the Iron Guard was. My first, it wasn't that long after that, I read my first book on the Legion, which is from a Marxist. But even there, enough came through that I began to realize that these are my people. And then I began to, you know, this is just around the time the internet had come out. This is 96, 97. Not a whole lot was online yet. I began sending away for the books. And I mean, before I knew it, I was a full supporter of this movement. But National Socialism is, generally speaking, a Christian movement. Was that way in Hungary. It was that way in Spain, in Portugal. It certainly was that way in Romania. It was that way in Greece. Overwhelmingly, this was a Christian movement. But National Socialism, Fascism, they're not identical, but they're similar. They came into existence for two reasons. And this is why you can't really take them out of the historical context. Number one, the fact that you had this massive empire, the Stalinist empire, right pretty much on their border, would frighten them. It frightened everyone. It frightened most leftists were scared of this. Fascism was a way to mobilize the power of the state, of the society, to stress unity, so as to make war on Stalinism. And the second thing is the fact that the democratic systems of the world, as they are doing now, clearly failed to deal with the Depression. Every place, Hitler included, that these movements came to power, there's a very good reason why they were popular. In every place they took power, the Depression had been extremely severe. You had two or three major parties, none of whom had any real effective plan. They kind of went back and forth. Elections were really meaningless. They had more in common than otherwise. They had no, the banks and the major industrial firms controlled everything. And therefore, nothing was ever done. Unemployment is, 30-40%. And in this case now, in America, it's about 30% if you actually use the real figure rather than the propaganda figure. And National Socialism has both elements. It has a national element and it has a socialist element. It was the fascist movement that created the concept of the paid vacation, the rise in worker better conditions and better wages. The working class was always the backbone of these movements. I'm going to talk about the brief period of time where General Antonescu and the Legion kind of fought each other as they came to power in 1940. And even there, brief period of time, they were successful. Wherever these movements have come to power, they were extremely successful. Franco's Spain saw double-digit economic growth throughout the 50s and 60s. Now, Germany, we know. And your military spending was not a huge part of the recovery. I mean, it was, maybe 10-15% of the recovery came from military spending. Wherever they went, they did very well. In Serbia, with Ljotic, I had a talk on him many years ago. It was a Christian, an Orthodox National Socialism even there. They never had a chance to develop since the Red Army had taken and Tito had taken over after that. But wherever they have gone, they were popular, and they're popular because they delivered the goods, economically speaking. The Legion of the Archangel Michael, the creation of Quadrianum, and it begins from a religious foundation. We live in an age where everything is inverted. It's a carnival. The literal concept of carnival, it means goodbye meat. It's what you do before to have some fun before the fast begins. But it's where everything is inverted. It's the arcane sense of a carnival. Kids tell parents what to do. And material values are superior to spiritual ones. And we take that for granted now. That's normal for us. Even just now, making reference to the fact that they were successful economically, therefore they were successful. That's, even we fall for that. Like, that is the sine qua non of success. But Codrianu and Antonescu, the General Antonescu was not greatly allied with the Iron Guard. We have to make that clear. I thought for years that was true. I'm very wrong. He saw democratic governments, and wherever the fascists came to power, they saw this. Democracy was a complete disaster. It cannot deal successfully with major crises. It cannot deal with systematic crises. World War II broke out. The only way to get the U.S. out of the Depression, the federal government, by some bizarre constitutional authority that I've never heard, was able to take over the entire American economy, forcing it to produce what the state needed for the war effort. So that certainly wasn't democratic. And FDR simply just packed the Supreme Court with his friends. So democracy cannot deal, liberal democracy, I am not talking about representative government, by the way. A liberal democracy cannot deal with crisis. It cannot deal with moral collapse. It cannot deal with any real systematic issue that torments society. We have a situation where most of the wealth is controlled by a handful of companies, a handful of families. Political information comes from a handful of media conglomerates. Liberal democracy is completely helpless against that. The founding fathers of the United States couldn't possibly have conceived of that. The concept of democracy, at least in theory, according to Codriano, is equality, that one idea is as good as another. Now, we know in practice, you know, the U.S., as it forces the system on countries abroad, bans whatever parties it doesn't want. So in Iraq, the Ba'ath Party was banned. The Social Nationalist Party was banned. So, but in theory, it has this idea that all views are equal. Evidence, therefore, doesn't matter. Reason, therefore, doesn't matter. My personal opinion is, if you take self-interest and that egocentric drive for money and power and prestige out of the equation, truth isn't that hard to find. It's that we have interest. We can't accept certain things as true. And so we end up with cognitive dissonance, as so many people have. I'm finding these days that people are finding ways to deal with cognitive dissonance. And especially when you consider the idea that if you truly believe that ideas are equal one to another, that evidence really doesn't matter, and therefore truth doesn't exist. John Stuart Mill, in his On Liberty, made some very stupid arguments. One of the stupidest is that the way to get to truth is to make sure all ideas have a equal hearing. Now, that is, especially in areas of science and philosophy, that makes a lot of sense. My ideas could certainly go up against anyone at any time. That's not really the liberal idea in practice. But the assumption that he makes is that people care about the truth. And it's simply false. People don't. Truth is of no interest to them. What matters is their own self-interest. What matters is justifying their position, justifying their lifestyle, their own ego. Truth, that is to say, that an idea is in accordance with the facts as we see it, or the facts as we know it, is not important. That doesn't move anybody. And I'm 45 years old, and I still have this inexplicable naivete where I can't wrap my brain around that. I still believe that if I just show people that they are incorrect, that they're wrong, they're factually incorrect, that eventually they're going to have to convert, they're going to have to change. And it never happens. And the only conclusion is that this doesn't matter. The concept of truth, the factual truth, is irrelevant. If anything, it's a threat. So that's John Stuart Mill's big problem here. Politically speaking, Codriano says that there is no continuity. And this was especially the case in places where the fascists came to power, like in Spain or Romania, where you had a 2-3 party system. They went back and forth. One was elected, the other one was elected, and policies changed. Now, in Italy, for example, you know, you've had how many? The average government in Italy from 1946 lasts about a year. And yet, in Italy, they became a major industrial power since the Second World War, suggesting that politicians really don't matter at all. Because the important thing is that there is a professional civil service, not to mention the private sector. There is where you have the continuity. But of course, that completely destroys democratic theory. Because the civil service is important, but the issue is that therefore elected politicians are meaningless people. These are meaningless people. Politicians come and go in Italian life, and yet there was a great degree of continuity in terms of economic policy, meaning that the private sector and the bureaucracy, that matters. Unfortunately for Democrats, that completely underscores the point that politicians don't really have power. Politics gets cut off from the idea of the common good. The common good implies that there is a society. A society implies that there is a single language in the broad sense, a broad moral consensus on what's right and what's wrong, a broad spiritual consensus on the purpose of our life. There and only there can you start talking about the common good, things that affect us as human beings, not necessarily as a member of a party, but that they affect us as human beings. That parties are continually in competition, so they're always trying to undermine one another. So if the other party is in power, it's in the interest of the party out of power to make things as bad as it could be. It's constantly a blame-shifting game. In monarchies, as you see with Tsar Nicholas II, even if it's not his fault, he takes the blame for it. Absolutism has nothing to do with power. It has to do with the fact of responsibility. It also has no authority. It has no authority because if you believe that ideas are generally equal, then nothing has authority. Authority and power are two different things. When someone says that I'm an authority in Russian history, it doesn't mean I have power over something. Authority gives one the right to have power over something. Now, power is just naked coercion. Authority gives one the right to use that. That's the central issue. There is no authority by definition if you're claiming that evidence really doesn't matter and logic really doesn't matter. But coming from the Enlightenment, this obsession with scientific accuracy, which in and of itself is not a problem, and yet in the most intimate areas of our social life, that all gets thrown out the window and everything is relative. Reason and evidence don't matter and don't apply. There is no authority. There is only power. There is this inherent drive that either the banking establishment or the civil service or some other hidden power actually runs things using these elections as cover. And we know, and I've said this many times on this show before, it comes from the Italian city-state of Florence and the Medici's taking over, buying the city, but making sure that the old republican institutions continue to exist. Codriano's big problem with democracy is that politics is a specialized field. Now, I have made this argument 1,000 times, and it doesn't penetrate at all. Politics, in fact, is one of the most difficult, highly specialized fields that any real statesman has to deal with, so many extremely important issues, any one of which requires a tremendous amount of study. That even a minor issue in social life is usually of great complexity. That somehow this could be put to a vote. I mean, you see the debate. Now, I haven't watched a debate on television in years because, you know, I don't want to get stupider. These are wastes of your time. Nothing of substance gets brought up. It can't. These are highly scripted things with the media, and then both campaigns agree to what's going to happen. Nothing can be left to chance, or the debate simply won't happen. I think the last time there was an actual debate was in 1960, Nixon versus Kennedy. And that didn't go the way the system wanted it to. That there is a elite, a political elite, a natural elite, and it's at least in part those who have mastered the technical field of political life. Now, of course, the real reason that all of a sudden, you know, the only area of life that's relative is morals and politics is because it is completely amoral. When you have in Romania, you had, you know, a handful of foreigners, Jews and Germans and others dominating the economy, where you have bankers running everything, attempting, doing everything in their power to not be noticed. They can't be talking about moral absolutes. Wherever capitalism has gone, it has been revolutionary. It has destroyed any sense in absolute power and absolute moral truth. Because capitalism in this mature stage takes over the state and then uses politicians as people to blame when something goes wrong. So they protest the government for a failing economy, as if the government controls, you know, interest rates or investment decisions. They won't protest Warren Buffett's house, but they protest the government, who has absolutely no power over these things. They're a very good fall guy for this. The nation is a central actor in the Iron Guard's idea. Their world, there's three real entities that are worth talking about. Number one, there's the individual. That also, and I don't like this, they don't mention the family, but the individual, it's implied that the individual has been properly raised, comes from the family. Number two, there is what we might call the civic nation, which is not really a nation. It's a civic polity, the population within any particular set of borders. And then number three, the ethno-nation, those people of a specific language, again, using language in a very, very broad sense. The nation, really only the latter one, is of interest to the Iron Guard. The nation is a biological entity. It's a spiritual entity. It's this ethno-nation that includes ancestors long dead, our present world, and those yet to be born. The purpose of the nation in Codriano's writings is resurrection. What he means by that is that it must be attached to the gospel. The nation should become a church. In Romania's case, it should become an Orthodox church, as it should be. Otherwise, the tradition of a people, to me, is just dead. It's a dead matter. It's of no particular interest to me. The spiritual life has to come first. Tradition doesn't have any particular authority unless it's attached to a spiritual truth. Now, in Romania, as in many places in Europe at the time, the Jews were the primary concern. Prior to World War II, very few people denied that the Jews were a problem in human society. Interestingly enough, if you read the literature, even non-elite literature around the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, most people who were there saw Bolshevism as an ethnic movement, as a Jewish movement. This is one of the reasons why no one really thought it was going to last very long. Codriano said that they controlled commerce and finance, spreading the myth that Romanians are simply too stupid, or at least not devious enough to really be in that field. They were the middle class, so to speak, and they kept a real Romanian middle class from coming into existence. Now, the peasants especially hated them. They used all means, fair and foul, to bring them into incredibly high debt. But the Kahal was of immense power and had a tremendous amount of money and used this influence to bribe state officials and private sector officials who were very, very paid very poorly at the time, and that most of the leases, the majority of the leases of the era, were held by Jews. This is especially the case in the agricultural world. And it's not an accident. This is the first place that the government, the legionary government, so-called, within the state of Antonescu, begins its reform. About 2,000 landowners controlled most of Romania. One Jewish family, the Fischers, it was a Jew from Austria-Hungary, controlled about 75% of Moldova. But these people were hated, and with good reason. Because at the time, and even today, you know, the Jews have this notion that they deserve this. This is their destiny, to control the world. Now, this Jewish control, or the control of the economy by any foreign group, makes it impossible for any real social movement to develop. Because for a society to be reborn, resurrected, for this to happen, there has to be a commitment of resources, money, and labor. When most of this is being controlled by foreigners, and I don't want to mention Jews as well as Germans. Germans were big in the Romanian economy, and this is something that, you know, they had no particular problem with Germans as such, but economically in Romania, they did have a problem with it. And there was a movement when the Iron Guard took over briefly in 1940 to make enterprises Romanian and kicking a lot of these people out. And once you have a situation like that, the ruling class then exists, or actually it is a ruling class, only because it's able to charge rents. The concept of rent is the very definition of corruption. A rent is any economic resource that is extracted from people because of a non-economic position. So it's not anything over and above a normal market exchange. So if you have a position of power in society, you know, you could charge more for your goods. If you have the power to get rid of your opponents, you could charge more for goods. To bribe an official to let you open a business, this is a rent. It is the very definition of corruption. There would be no corruption. That is what corruption is. Now, the opposite of this is love. Now, I've mentioned this before. The term in English, you know, I wince even saying it. And I shouldn't, because in English, it's now, like so many words, has been completely bereft of its original meaning. Codriano spends some time defining what love is. He defines it in two ways. First, that it's the intersection of liberty and authority. The ordered life, where everything has its place. You think of an ecosystem. Any given ecosystem, that the pieces of it exist through a relation of love. Love, then, for human beings, is when that interrelation becomes conscious. It is dependency, but not an unhealthy dependency. And the other way he defines it as being the opposite of mechanism. Mechanism is just cause and effect without purpose, the machine. That's the opposite of love for him. Love is the opposite of that. It is consciousness. Reason and consciousness imply that the human being is free. That is above and has come above and beyond cause and effect. So that's what he means by it being the opposite of mechanism. In America, 2016, it's a nonsense word. It's said all the time. I think it's normally used as a substitute for some kind of a lustful relation between men and women sometimes. But often, I think, when it's ever used socially, it's referred to as indulgence. That you love somebody, therefore you let them do whatever you want. Mechanism would be a system of justice that is healthy. But a judge will give the right decision, the just decision, because he has to. Because it's a healthy system, and therefore he must follow the proper procedure, and that leads to justice. In and of itself, that's not love. Love is when he does it, even regardless of that. Love is what happens when he does it just because, even if he were in a completely unhealthy system. In the Orthodox Church, there's a tendency to make love and justice very different from each other. Justice is just giving every man what he deserves. Love is when you don't do that. Someone has hurt you, but you understand his position. You see what you know that he's suffering, whatever it is, and you don't punish him because you know this isn't something that's it's just. It isn't justice in the mechanistic, in juridical sense. It's a matter of freedom. You know, no court system court systems in the West are very mechanistic. Court systems in the East have a tendency to be based on local custom, and it's the elders of the community that are, and usually preferred to the secular judges. There's a freedom there where they do the right thing because, you know, this is what they want to do. They do the right thing even if they were punished for it. So, love is simply the addition of freedom and consciousness to the right thing. Now, a nation comes to grow in subjective knowledge. We know that a nation refers to a group of people speaking one language, but that one language comes from many, many years of interaction with each other, with the outside world, and with its environment, its topography. That could objectively be the case without people realizing that they form a nation. Now, when they become aware that they are a separate people, often through persecution, they then begin developing the subjective awareness of themselves as a distinct people. Now, I get asked once in a while about the concept of this natural leadership principle, Codriano's concept that a leadership will naturally manifest itself in some mysterious way. This is what he means. The greater the level of subjective awareness of any community, the easier it will be for the right people to take leadership positions at the right time. It's like an organism. It's aware of itself as separate and distinct and worthy of survival and flourishing. The closer that unity and the greater the subjective awareness of it, the masses of the population, the easier it will be for a leader to show himself. The greater the unity of any group of people, the less democracy makes sense in its theoretical sense. Why was it that the founding fathers hated the concept of political parties so much? Because they saw them as economic factions, which of course they are. They saw them as constantly competing, hurting society for the sake of their own good. A unified society, subjectively aware of its unity, doesn't really need competing political parties. It needs a unified leadership. It wouldn't even make sense to have a fragmented leadership over a unified country. There is a code of conduct of people, legionnaires, as well as leadership. Code of conduct that, at least among the masses of the population, will produce the right leader at the right time. First of all, discipline, the rejection of your own will, humility. Humility is just that my ego is not the only thing that mattered. Number two, constant work, including when it's thankless. You know, building our own institutions, building our own economic foundation, you know, so much of that work is dirty. So much of that work is not going to get you into the newspaper, and so people don't want to do it. Number three, silence. Too many words get you into trouble. I make my living with words. They've gotten me into nothing but trouble. A legionnaire and a good citizen is very clear when he speaks and speaks only when absolutely necessary. Justice is very important. As I mentioned before, you do the right thing, even if it will lead to you developing a reputation as being someone who's unjust. In a healthy society, people will be just because everyone else is. That's what they think they have to do. They're not really subjectively choosing it. But you live in an unhealthy society like we do. Doing the right thing will get you the reputation of being a rotten guy. But we do it anyway. We just don't care about that kind of thing. That also is very much part of rejecting your ego and your self-will. Don't worry about it. And importantly, you never abandon a brother. Now, in the church, a brother doesn't refer to just anybody. Brother refers to another Orthodox person or an honest person seeking the truth. May not be Orthodox. You see it in the Good Samaritan. It was not just Orthodox people. Now, those who are fighting us, those who are full of guile and want to hurt us, they are not brethren. Obviously, in the Old Testament, the Canaanites were not brethren. Elijah, who Christ was communing with on Mount Tabor in the Transfiguration, clearly Elijah killed a lot of people. They were not brothers. The priests of Baal were not brothers. So clearly it's not everybody. I've always said be very, very careful about the words any and all, and every, especially, everyone. That concept didn't exist in the ancient world, everyone. The concept of the world didn't refer to planet Earth. It referred to civilization. All and everyone, even if they use the term and it gets translated that way, they don't mean every single living person. They're referring to a specific class of people. Our enemies who are openly enemies, and especially if our enemies are aware of what the alternative is, they are not brethren. They don't get put into this mold. The only exception to that is if you think that being kind to them will bring them to us. Then we have an obligation. We can't do anything that would harm the church or the nation or the national movement. So even if they're not brothers, if we think that being kind to them will change their minds, then we have an obligation. But absolutely, positively, it refers to other Orthodox people and other Orthodox nationalists especially. They are never to be disdained. If they're in trouble, if there's something wrong with them, if they're very poor, if they're just getting out of prison, something like that, and this was the case in Romania quite often, you absolutely have to help them. There are 10 laws that were passed out to Legion members early on in the movement's existence. And these are for everybody. These are especially for leaders, but these also are the ways to bring about conditions such that the right person will end up being a leader. That if we hold to these laws and to these rules, the chances of justice being done in general are very high. Number one, to reject the media. He's saying this in the late 30s. When we follow this political movement in the church, that is where truth is to be found. Strangers come up to us and start talking, pay no attention. You see something in the rotten newspapers at the time, pay no attention. Number two, take great care of who you associate with. Number three, be very careful for people that you don't know. Now, the concept of stranger just isn't someone we don't know personally, but someone who's not our kind, who may be very nice to us. We need to be very careful. This may be a ploy of some kind. Number four, money is to be rejected entirely. We do what we do, even if it leads to total poverty. The minute we take money for some political action, we're already corrupted. And then number five, we do not accept gifts. Number six, reject flattery. People who praise us, especially if they praise us a lot, don't pay any attention to them. Number seven, as we said before, self-sacrifice for the brethren. Number eight, we will be judged by the company that we keep. Number nine, stop worrying. Do what you're supposed to do, regardless of the consequences. God is going to reward you. God will fight for us. This is essential to the Iron Guard. And finally, number 10, prayer is essential, especially prayer for the dead, and especially prayer for those who have died fighting for our cause. Now, a lot of that is connected only to members of the Legion. But in a legionary state, in a society that is healthy and run by Christian principles, that is extremely important. The concept of brother, I mean, for Quadriano, it depends on who he's speaking with. He sometimes is referring to just members of the movement, in which case we are to sacrifice everything we have for them if we absolutely need to, knowing full well that we would get the same. He's referring to Orthodox people, wherever they might be from. The same goes for them. Also, as well as all Romanians, you know, are people, whether it be racially or ethnically. But never do you hear, and you don't hear this in the ancient world either, everybody, or just anybody. And keep in mind, when Christ refers to enemies, he is not referring to his own enemies. He had very, very nasty, harsh words for his own enemies. Enemies of the church, enemies of God. And he's referring to our personal enemies. It is perfectly consistent with love, in the true sense of the word, to shut someone up. Edmund Burke says the same thing about rights. Stupid people have the right to be shut up because they're hurting people. It's odd to state rights that way, but it makes sense. It's just. You don't chime in on these things when you can poison the debate, can poison the discussion. Edmund Burke says that the doctrine of rights should include the right not to engage in political discourse. And he's not even referring to the right of the community not to hear you, but to the person. You know, it's very, very common, very famous for Socrates to say that it's much better to suffer injustice than to commit it. And the argument's very simple, that committing injustice hurts you. You become habituated to it. It becomes normal for you. Suffering it forces us to reconsider who we are and what we're doing. It can be good for us over time. Pain and suffering are not the worst things in the world. In fact, they could be very positive. It's hard to say that to someone in the middle of it, you know, in the middle of a terrible time. But many of us can look back and see that some of our most productive periods in our life is when we were suffering badly, because we have no choice. And those points, those times, to sit down and to call on God, often because we have no other choice, and to make absolutely certain that we know who we are and what we're doing. We consolidate all of our forces. In the same way, fascism wants to consolidate all the forces of the nation in times of great stress and suffering and challenge. Now, these rules and laws that you find in Quadriano's works are often very difficult to make into political principles. Now, these guys aren't, you know, they're not stupid in that respect. These are for, at best, I mean, they're hard to follow even for members of the organization. I mean, how many of us would really suffer and suffer a lot for the sake of helping somebody in need? You know, I spent many hours tutoring students that weren't mine in a subject that I know something about. And these students have long since forgotten who I am. You know, in that case, it's really just a matter of professional obligation. And doing the right thing, it comes with being a professional historian or whatever we happen to be, or a political activist. These are very difficult. But when this is applied to a society, especially a suffering society, it's another matter. Now, for a year, roughly 1940, the Iron Guard came to power along with, and at the same time, the coup of General Antonescu. This is a time in Romanian life that very few people know about, they talk about. Porosima's book on the topic is what I reference here. Previously, I was just referring to Quadriano's works, but now Sima's explanation as to the legionary state, it was called, and its success, even for the brief period of time it existed, its success. The one thing that makes Romania strange is that Germans were somewhat of a hostile minority, and that Sima and the Iron Guard in general said that Germans and Jews were making a common front against the Iron Guard. And this was a big problem in the relationship between General Antonescu and the legionary state. Because the legion wanted all foreigners out, including them. That's kind of a problem if you want to have close relationships with Germany. Germany is buying Romanian oil. Any country at the time, like Yugoslavia prior to the coup, that had attached themselves to Germany at that time would take off. They would do well on Germany's coattails. Now, the Jewish domination of Romanian commerce is admitted by everyone in the field, mainstream or otherwise. And the same thing goes for, you know, Jews in Poland, Jews in Ukraine. And they spread the myth that, you know, Romanians were just the country bumpkins and that they didn't know what it was like to be involved in commerce, which is an insult and a compliment. What had occurred in most of Eastern Europe was that Jews over time ended up controlling most of the countryside. You know, the peasant, wily and intelligent, still sees the good in people, does not have the cynical hatred that the Jew has, especially in the Kahal system at the time. One of the first laws that's passed in 1940 is that Jews are forbidden to own anything in the countryside, with mills, land, anything like this. They were expropriated. They did not get their property legitimately, and they went to the German, or the Saxons in particular. Now, that was the mining part, same thing in Yugoslavia. They were excellent miners, and they were brought in, and this became a big problem for Romanian foreign policy. But other than expropriating the Jews, their interest in the working class was very typical. You see this everywhere. The cheap credit for the peasantry was essential. The state would guarantee very low or no interest rates on loans so that they could compete with the Jewish moneylender. You know, the Jews, the Kahal, was willing to lose money for the sake of future market share. We call it dumping today. Miners were a big problem. Mining is extremely difficult. I mean, Romans used to send people to the mines as punishment. A lot of diseases ran rampant among miners, German or Romanian. And they radically increased the amount of money spent on medical care for miners. And they created the minimum wage that didn't exist at the time. This is especially important in countries that don't have that have most of their capital from owned by foreigners. They don't really care. I mean, capitalists don't care about people anyway. It makes it even worse when they're foreign. And in some industries, wages went up by over 70%. It's because they started at such a low level. But in general, about 10%. That year saw the increase in wages, and even there, it was very low, especially relative to profits. But this was something that was forced by the legionary state. Horace Sima and others mentioned that Jews were deforesting the country. They simply didn't care, that they had no particular interest in any long-term development, and certainly didn't care about Romania, so they would strip an area, whether it be in mining or forestry, and just, you know, and then just move on. This is something that was made illegal. Many debts were canceled, especially in rural areas. And all wherever you are, conditions were radically improved. The Ministry of Labor, the Ministry of Interior, developed commissions and you know, teams that would actually go out and see these things, make reports, and fix it. This was especially needed in the mines. Because the medical problems in the mines, not just coal mines, but elsewhere, as well as the oil industry, these were severe. And when you have a huge surplus of labor and a foreign owner, yeah, they don't really care. The legionary government put a stop to this. One of the great things that developed was that because of this, there was a great degree of confidence of ordinary Romanians in the economy, and tax collection was streamlined. Well, not handed out to tax farmers, but the revenue collected by the legionary state was to the point where they had a budget surplus for the first time. the confidence that people had, expropriations of Jewish industries, the complete smashing of all forms of speculation and charging of rents, you had a budget surplus. This, by the way, was condemned by General Antonescu, and this is where they clashed. Antonescu was claiming that when you do this kind of thing, you're attacking the free market. You were trying to expropriate things, and therefore you're against the idea of private property. And this is where the two of them fought one another. And in fact, Antonescu ended up persecuting violently the Iron Guard for this, suggesting that money was coming to him from these sources. Military requisitions were taking a tremendous toll on the peasantry. And one of the things that the minimum wage and the increase in wages, mining actually went up by almost 100% in the brief time of the legionary government. And they realized that profits did not go down very much. When these companies would complain and say that you're forcing us to pay workers more, our profits are going to suffer, and we're going to go elsewhere. But as it turns out, according to Sima's statistics, it was a very minor chunk out of their profits, partially because everything else that the Legion was doing politically, not to mention the connection with Germany, was increasing overall confidence in the economy. Profits did not really go down, even though workers were doing much better. For some reason, capitalists can't grasp the idea that well-paid workers are better for the system than minimum wage workers, than the lowest possible wage you can get away with. This is, you know, it seems common sense, but this is demand side rather than supply side. Now, Sima mentions that the wages of government workers were increased. It's like in the Philippines now, the president there has increased the wages of most government employees, but also policemen especially, and those involved in the fight in the drug war. Because low wages for these guys makes them very susceptible to bribes. And that had been the case in Romania. I should also note that the Iron Guard avoided putting its own people in these positions. They did not want to be accused of simply handing out positions to their favorites. They did not appoint ministers from their own ranks. They appointed ministers that they could trust. But they hated the notion that this is just a spoils system, because that's how the democracies had functioned. That's how liberal democracy functions in general. It's built right into American history. And that's not, they wanted to avoid anything democratic like that, and so they wouldn't do this. It was a meritocracy, and it was something where moral virtue really mattered. They wanted to create a system, as difficult as this is, where nice guys didn't always finish last. So one of the main things to understand about the legionary government in Romania was that they were absolutely obsessed with the notion of government workers living a very pure life. But they had to be Christians, they had to be Romanians, they didn't have to be members of the guard, but they had to be very trustworthy. Sima himself advocated the death penalty for those corrupt ministers, people who took bribes, and all their property expropriated. So much of this windfall of the Romanian government at the time came from the legitimate expropriation of corrupt people. And it was legitimate. And very few people fought it. Same thing, you know, getting rid of the Jewish domination of the countryside was so outrageous and had been entered into by such fraudulent means. It just meant that the government was very popular, as most of these governments were. A second issue to keep in mind is that the Jews were paying taxes out of fear. All of a sudden, the Kahal was very interested in paying its taxes and making sure they had no arrears. There were no pogroms whatsoever, although that had been accused of nothing having. The Jews were screaming that the Iron Guard is going to take over, they're going to kill us all. That was not the case. They were expropriated. But no one was hurt, at least not directly because of the guard. There may have been local riots and things like that, but that's not their fault. There was no pogroms. But the Jews were still very worried. They can't get away with what they used to, and so now they're very scrupulous in paying taxes and making sure that their employees, whatever they had left, were paid very, very well. Number three, remember too, because of the reform of the government, because people had confidence in this for the first time in a long time, because they saw a populist, a nationalist, and socialist government in power, paying taxes, showing up to work was not as difficult as it had been. They didn't have a problem with it. Even military requisitions, from Antonescu's point of view, were much easier because of this. Number four, confidence returned to the society as a whole. Number five, Germany is buying oil. And because of the demand, the German economy is taking off at the time, oil prices are going up because the demand is increasing. But number six, the concept of economic growth, the fact that they announced a budget surplus, all of this plowed back into infrastructure and especially in medical care, which was desperately needed in the countryside. Transylvania, we had a lot of refugees from Hungarian pogroms and riots. It becomes its own reward. It feeds on itself. That economic growth creates more confidence, and confidence creates more economic growth. And all of this creates a tremendous amount of legitimacy for the system as a whole. Number seven, and this is very important, massive redistribution of land. It's not just the Jews were expropriated, or Germans, or even Romanians that held way more than anyone could possibly use. You know, land was lying fallow. It was the same situation with Chavez in Venezuela. You know, if you're holding land that is not being used, you shouldn't have it anymore. And we need that to be planted. There was a huge redistribution of all of this capital, and whether it be money, political power, land, tools, mills, all this stuff was redistributed. So people finally were receiving a just reward for their work, which has an unspeakable effect on the population as a whole. And where you have rising wages because of economic growth, you have rising wages because of great confidence, you have rising wages because the state is forcing it, confidence goes up even further. And the guard government, the government of Antonescu at the time, throughout 1940, especially the fall of 1940, was very popular. The world's press, including the German press, unfortunately, you know, the German minority was very, very successful in some places. They were complaining to Hitler about the Iron Guard, and the relations were not very good. This government did not last long, unfortunately. And everything that they did was destroyed. I've said this before, I'll say it a million more times, that I've been studying Soviet legislation my entire life, and I have yet to come across anything that improved the life of workers. And that's because workers weren't relevant to the worker state, believe it or not. You know, it's a real scam. It's a trick. It's a parlor trick. Labor referred to people like Trotsky and Schiff, had nothing to do with actual workers who they hated, and especially peasants. The Jews both hate and fear the Aryan peasant, Romanian and elsewhere, especially because the peasant always was self-sufficient, whether it be in a communal structure in Russia or more individual like in Romania or Ukraine. They were self-sufficient. The yeomanry was a central concept in Jefferson's concept of political freedom in America, late 18th century. There is a sense of self-sufficiency built into the very notion of the peasantry. It's a very positive thing, and people who live off of rents and power fear that. So, to sum this up, the Iron Guard actually took power, and this is easily applicable to our situation. Confidence is what drove the economy. It wasn't just these ridiculous fragmented parties who didn't believe a word of what they said, you know, switching places by every election. It was a powerful government, more powerful than the industrialists, more powerful than the banks, who was dedicated to giving people their actual rewards for the work that they did. Not the work that others did, but they themselves did. That confidence, although you can't measure it economically, and therefore it's invisible to economists, confidence in the system is incredible. And that's one thing that Americans don't have in 2016. That's one thing Western Europeans don't have in 2016. Russians have it. People in the Crimea have it because they see that they have leadership like this. A strong leadership, social unity, ethno-nationalism creates the confidence you need for economic growth. Anyway, thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.